I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, the House January 6th committee filled in the blanks about what former President Trump was doing at the White House while his supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol, engaging in hand-to-hand combat with the police, endangering members of Congress who were there to certify the 2020 presidential election, and looking for former Vice President Mike Pence to hang him. A gallows had been built on the Capitol grounds. This was the 187 minutes between the end of Trump's Stop the Steal speech at the Ellipse, where he told his supporters he would go with them to the Capitol, to the release of his video telling the rioters and protesters to go home, we love you. During those three-plus hours, he sat in the White House dining room and watched the melee on Fox News. The committee revealed that Trump chose to do nothing to stop the insurrection, nor did he call in the military or National Guard or other security to help the Capitol Police, even though members of his family, his White House staff, Republican members of Congress, and Fox News hosts begged him to call off the mob. Our guest Madeline Dean was in the gallery on January 6th, fearing for her life. She represents Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District and joins us on Radio Times. Representative Dean, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Hello, Marty. It's good to be with you, and I was there last night in the hearing room.
I know you've been attending a number of these hearings. Have they given you any closure about what happened that day?
Oh, an interesting way of putting it. I sat last night with Annie Custer, Veronica Escobar, and others, and I wouldn't say it is me closure, but I do think it is important to bear witness. And that's why I've been to as many of the hearings as I possibly can, to bear witness to what happened, not just, well, initially personally for me, because I was in the gallery that day, taken out, told to put on a gas mask, terrifying my family by calling them. So I have found it important in terms of just personal dealing with the terrorizing of that day, but really more importantly, and it's not closure, but for us as Americans, as patriots who believe in our constitutional order and our duty under our oath, I feel it's very important that we learn as much as we possibly can about this extraordinary dereliction of duty, really an active dereliction of duty by the former president.
So many of us, and I'm sure you have watched the various videos of the attack. I certainly have watched them, and it gets no easier. And in fact, in certain ways, it gets even harder because of what we've learned about what the former president didn't do. He knew that some of these people were armed, for instance. He put his vice president in danger. And somehow, even watching those videos, it seems more worrisome and more dangerous. When you watch those videos, what's your experience?
That very same feeling. I lived a portion of it. Obviously, I did not come right up against the mob. In fact, when we were hauled out, I thought in my mind it must be only a dozen people, a couple dozen people, all right, maybe 50 people. Had no idea the number of people, nor the weaponry and the viciousness of it. The videos do not get easier to watch. The sounds of those videos, the vicious nature of the mob, the smashing of the windows of the Capitol, and then the willingness to crawl through screaming, hang Mike Pence, and to know juxtapositioned with that was the president sitting in his private dining room doing nothing to reach out to Mike Pence to say, are you all right? I will do everything in my power to protect you. And in fact, saying things like, well, maybe he deserves it. Tweeting out that incendiary tweet that said Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do the right thing. As some of the witnesses last night said, he poured gasoline on a fire that he lit.
In fact, the two witnesses said that was the moment in which they actually quit their jobs at the White House. You talked about the sounds, and I wonder, again, in hindsight, sort of how close you and others in the gallery came to interacting or seeing or even coming close to this mob of insurrectionists?
The closest that I know I came, because our escape route was weird and completely unplanned. And in fact, they had to move us twice because they had taken us to an unsafe spot. So I don't know how close in hallways I came. But as we were up in the gallery, and Annie Custer and Veronica were a part of that, along with many others, Pramila Jayapal, when we were asked, instructed to get gas masks out from under our seats, which I did not know there were gas masks under the seats, I have to tell you that. When we were instructed, put them on because tear gas has been deployed in the rotunda, which is quite close. It was at that moment that we heard the pounding on the center doors down below us. The pounding, which is a sound that I think that's why it's so triggering. And then the piercing of that glass. It was at that point that literally kind of your mind goes into a little bit of a slow motion. And I thought, oh, my God, this is how you could become part of a terrible shooting event. Hmm. And the gallery is almost like a shooting gallery at a carnival. And so I kept hollering to Veronica, for example, because she was wearing a beautiful white jacket. I pictured an assault-style weapon spraying bullets across the gallery.
Wow.
I hollered at her, get down, get down. And we all crouched down behind the wall until we were instructed to call out. But that's the closest that I'm aware I came was when the doors right below us were being pounded upon and then pierced.
And they did breach the chamber. They came into the chamber.
That's correct. They came in through those doors.
What has been your relationship with your Republican colleagues after January 6th, especially those who either sided with the insurrectionists or seemed to minimize or explain away the insurrectionists, or even those who refused to certify the results of the election?
It's been very strained. And something I had hoped to come to Congress with was the chance to build relationships with people of all different kinds of issues that they cared about, different, ideological pieces of the spectrum. But certainly that day drew a line in the sand for me. You saw that we were determined to come back to the floor to complete our constitutional duty to certify the election. You saw that in the clips last night of the leaders huddled, Schumer, McConnell, Pelosi, Hoyer, Clyburn, and others saying, we're not leaving, we're going back on the floor. For me, at that point, I drew a line in the sand. For those who came back and still voted not to certify, I've made a choice, a legislative choice, that I won't co-lead with people who actually made that vote or made that choice. I won't co-lead legislation. I want their support. But somewhere you've got to draw a line and say, either I'm part of this problem, continuing the big lie, which many of my colleagues are continuing to do, or upon reflection, I regret that vote. I haven't heard many people say they regret that vote. It's been a strain.
The House is obviously an investigative body. It's really up to the Department of Justice if there are criminal charges. Do you think, based on all the hearings, that there's enough evidence to charge former President Trump with a crime or two or three?
What I want to lift up, and then I'll comment on the charging of crimes, what I want to lift up for your listeners is what this committee is tasked with. And that is revealing, sadly, the highest of constitutional crimes by the former president and many who were around him. But it was he who held and took the oath. It was he who was supposed to uphold our Constitution and protect us, protect his own vice president. So I'm really proud of the extraordinary work of this committee and those who have come forward with courage to tell what they knew. You notice they're all Republicans. They're all people, whether they are campaign, family, or staff, or advocates. They're all Republicans who believed in this president. What this committee has revealed are the highest of constitutional crimes by the person at the highest level of our government by the president. That's what they have revealed. That is what they are tasked, sadly, with, and they've done it, and they'll continue to do it. On the criminal side, I'm not a criminal lawyer. I think the Department of Justice, certainly through the work of the 1-6 committee, has a lot to chew on, but also a lot of gaps to fill in. If I were a part of whether it's Georgia State Prosecution or the DOJ, I'd be looking for what's missing. What was very revealing last night was, notice, the photographer, the presidential photographer, was not allowed to be with the president.
Right.
The call logs, a huge gap. The diary, the presidential diary, a huge gap. I'm sure your listeners know these are things that are meticulously kept in presidential records for all of history. And yet what's missing here is what was going on. The president did not, and we did get this information, did not call Department of Defense to say help out. National Guard didn't call the vice president. Instead, he spent time calling Rudy Giuliani and senators, and McCarthy called him to say, you've got to stop this. So there are huge gaps that I would think any criminal lawyer, any prosecutor would say, let's go fill in those gaps, and we will have the evidence of the criminality.
And we're almost out of time here. I do want to play a clip, and this is Representative Cheney's final remarks. She said in so many words that Donald Trump should never be allowed to run for president again. Let's give it just a quick listen, and then I'll get a quick response from you.
Donald Trump made a purposeful choice to violate his oath of office, to ignore the ongoing violence against law enforcement, to threaten our constitutional order. There is no way to excuse that behavior. It was indefensible. And every American must consider this. Can a president who is willing to make the choices Donald Trump made during the violence of January 6th ever be trusted with any position of authority in our great nation again?
Madeleine Dean, we have about 30 seconds. I'd be curious about your response to that. And we read that the former president is certainly considering another run for office.
I certainly appreciated Liz Cheney's closing remarks and what she has brought to the work of this committee. And that's what I was saying about the highest of constitutional crimes. We've never had to evaluate a president under that lens before. Or maybe the closest thing came Richard Nixon, but this so eclipses Richard Nixon. This person who could not bring himself, does not have the humanity to say, I'm so sorry for those who were injured, for those who died that day. He should not be trusted ever again to hold any office. I don't care if it's dog catcher.
Well, we got to leave it there. Madeleine Dean, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Congresswoman Madeleine Dean, representing Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District. She was in the gallery on January 6th. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Last night's January 6th hearing answered some of the questions about what former President Trump was doing while his supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol in an attempt to prevent the certification of Joe Biden as the next president of the United States. These were the 187 minutes between Trump's Stop the Steal speech and his video message to the violent mob to go home. We love you. We learned that he watched Fox News in the White House dining room and refused to call off the insurrectionists and refused to send in more troops to protect the police and secure the Capitol. He tweeted that his Vice President Mike Pence was a coward at the time Pence's life was in serious danger from Trump supporters. The two witnesses, Deputy White House Press Secretary Sarah Matthews and Matthew Pottinger, former National Security Council official, both told the committee they quit in response to that tweet. There was more from last night, and we have two guests who have joined us. Craig Green is professor of law at Temple University, a former Justice Department lawyer who worked for the George W. Bush administration. He also clerked for Merrick Garland. Craig Green, nice to have you with us on Radio Times once again.
Glad to be here. Love the show.
Oh, thank you so much. And Carol Lenig is with us as well, national investigative reporter for The Washington Post. She's also an MSNBC contributor. Wrote a book called Zero Fail, The Rise and Fall of the Secret Service. We will talk about the Secret Service. She's also co-author of A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. Carol Lenig, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, too.
Well, we have a lot to discuss. Let me just make sure our listeners can be part of our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Craig, let me begin with you, and it's sort of a broad-based question, and to you, Carol, as well. What was your major takeaway from last night's hearing?
Yeah, I think that a really good way of thinking of it is it's not just a failure to act, but it actually is a series of actions. And if you look at last night and the hearings together, you know, Trump summoned group people. He riled them up knowing they were heavily armed. He ordered them to march down the Capitol. And then in turn, they did effectively what he wanted. And the thing I would add is not only did he then sit and watch Fox News and call Rudy Giuliani, but he continued to try to upset the certification of the votes by calling senators and then eventually having a swearing a conversation with the majority leader to try to persuade them not to certify the election. So I think the thing the hearings have brought together through hours and hours of testimony and video clips is sort of the big picture of things, which I think people can get numbed to 18 months later. So I thought it was really vivid and brought it all back in a very important way.
And Carol, it was sort of defined as dereliction of duty. That seemed to be the kind of theme of the hour. What was your major takeaway?
Well, I had a couple, but I think the first and most important to me as an investigative reporter who sometimes thinks like a lawyer or a prosecutor is you really... Craig summarizes, you know, the big brush picture very, very well. But if you're a prosecutor at the Department of Justice, I think that this hearing brought to life was the president's state of mind. You had a sense of, with all the connective tissue that was provided, all the little teeny additional details that some people might not realize are new, that Donald Trump was not just egging on and teeing up this insurrection. He was enabling it, fueling it, and then ultimately trying to keep it on life support when it looked like it was going to fail, and when all of his aides were telling him that it was disgusting and unpatriotic, and urged him to call off his supporters and the rioters and tell them to go home. The state of mind that to me that was revealed was a Donald Trump, even after the insurrection, when cabinet secretaries were resigning left and right and senior aides were walking out the door with all of their belongings and saying goodbye to the White House forever. The day after, Donald Trump still is unable to say the election is over, unable and unwilling to acknowledge that his lie brought all this gruesome and terrifying attack on democracy. He, perhaps some another small detail, if you don't mind,
sure,
that is,
no, go ahead.
People are not paying enough attention to, is when Liz Cheney described Donald Trump seeming to realize that this wasn't going to work and that this was the only time that he agreed to issue the statement, when his effort to block the certification was defied by the Speaker of the House, the Senate Majority Leader, the Vice President, and most of the members on the floor. When it was defied and they were determined to stay and to clear the building, that is you know, after 3 hours of dereliction, when Donald Trump was willing to say something at the pleading of his aides.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on several things. Let me toss something to you quickly, Craig, because Carol talked about intent. And I mean, I think that's a legal term. I'm not a lawyer here, but that in a sense is a legal term, and it's important to understand, I guess, intent when it comes to criminal activity. Did we get closer to that?
I think let's talk about crimes a little separately, but I think this issue that Carol raised about intent and state of mind, I mean, when these heavily armed, and he knew they were heavily armed because of the magnetometers at his speech, these heavily armed folks marched their way down to the Capitol and then stormed their way in. I think the evidence asks the question, was Trump surprised or was he thrilled? And you can think, what did he imagine was going to happen? And then you could ask, well, what did he want to have happen? And I think the evidence in the aggregate, putting one detail on top of the next, this was not a mistake. This was not a surprise. And I think Trump's behavior seems shocking and unbelievable if you imagine he wanted peace and did not want the storming of the Capitol and did not want the disruption of congressional activities. But if you imagine that he did want those things, then actually his behavior and non-behavior makes an awful lot of sense. And so I think this is that state of mind issue. You know, what did he intend? What did he want to have happen? This was not some kind of things have gone off the rail. It really wasn't like that. And you can see it in almost every minute of the day, January 6th. Of course, he tweeted 20 times the day before to rile things up. So I think, you know, knowing what he knew and with the contacts that he had with Roger Stone and General Flynn, I think there was every reason to think that this actually is very close to what he expected. And if I could just say, if this had been Steve Bannon, Alex Jones, a private citizen, they would go to jail for sure. But I think the criminal implications for a president will be a little different. I'm sure we'll talk about that.
We will indeed talk about that. Let me play a clip, and this is the outtake clips, previously unseen outtakes from January 7th, so obviously the next day after the insurrection, showing the president refusing to acknowledge his defeat in the 2020 presidential election. And then, Carol, I'll give you a chance to respond, but it's about 55 seconds.
I would like to begin by addressing the heinous attack yesterday. And to those who broke the law, you will pay. You do not represent our movement. You do not represent our country. And if you broke the law, you can't say that. I already said you will pay. The demonstrators who infiltrated the Capitol have defied the seat of dust. It's defiled, right? See, I can't see it very well. Okay, I'll do this. I'm going to do this. Let's go. But this election is now over. Congress has certified the results. I don't want to say the election's over. I just want to say Congress has certified the results without saying the election's over, okay?
But Congress has certified. Now Congress.
Yeah, right.
Now Congress.
I didn't say over. So let me see. Don't go to the paragraph before.
And that was Ivanka's voice there. I don't want to say the election is over. And Carol, that stands today. I mean, the president still says the election was fraudulent and is not over.
That's right. He maintains it. He told me and my co-author, Phil Rucker, the same in March, just months after he left office, kind of unceremoniously, and with a lot of people saying good riddance. He told us that in this alternate reality he was living in, that he won by millions of votes and that many dead people voted, that all sorts of votes were switched in Pennsylvania, all sorts of people were voting using dead people's names in Arizona, all of the things that his attorney general told him repeatedly in December of 2020 that the Justice Department had investigated and found were bogus complaints, bogus claims with no validity. So, you know, if you have federal law enforcement officers investigating these things, conclude they are bogus, the president should have known they were bogus too and should know now. There's only one little wrinkle
Sure.
about determining whether or not former President Trump realizes this is a lie. And that is a moment, a conversation, a very tense conversation that he has with his then acting attorney general, who's replaced Bill Barr after Bill Barr resigned in late December, and with his deputy attorney general, acting deputy attorney general Donahue. The president beseeches them to just declare that the election in Georgia is problematic, has been corrupted, that there's fraud. And Donahue, the acting deputy attorney general, tells President Trump, you know, we can't just change the election results because you're asking us to. We can't do that. We have to have evidence. And Trump's response, and I'm paraphrasing him a little, but his response is, don't worry about that. Just say it. Just say it, and we'll do the rest. And to me, that is a glimmer of, in that exchange, that Trump doesn't believe that the election's been rigged. He just needs someone to say that it was.
And let me just get a response. And let me just sort of add to that in terms of all the things that former President Trump did or tried to do. He certainly threatened state election officials, pressured the Secretary of State in Georgia. He was told by Barr and others that he had lost, and yet he sought out people who would tell him that he had won. He even considered the idea of seizing voting machines. He pressured Vice President Trump while the mob was calling for his hanging. I could go on from there. He pulled in people that were really conspiracy theorists who had the most preposterous ideas and decided to believe them and nobody else. And I guess, Craig, going back to you again, when you add all that stuff up together, where does that leave us?
Yeah, and I think a real pattern is this, which is shown through the hearings, how often President Trump didn't care about the facts. So he's a conversation almost exactly like that with Representative Bowers from Arizona, where he says, maybe you can't do this, but just try and let the courts figure it out. He tells the Secretary of State in Georgia, you know, just find me the votes. He tells, Carol was mentioning, tells the DOJ, just say it was fraudulent or corrupt, and we'll work it out from there. And I think that for any other person, the inference would be that he was, for example, to use a legal word, he was trying to commit fraud. And the only defense is, well, maybe Trump believes a lot of crazy things. But when you look at one episode on top of 50 other episodes across months, and then, of course, it continues to this day, it doesn't seem like a mistake. It doesn't seem like an error in factual judgment. It really starts to seem like a strategy. And I think that that's really been, from the very first words that Representative Cheney said at the beginning, that's been the strategy of the hearing from the beginning, is to show this broad arc of how things really do fit together. And I think that that's, you know, I think there's no question that when on January 6th, Donald Trump refuses to stop the violence, refuses to order people out of the Capitol, when every other person, that's what you hear from his White House counsel, they say everybody wanted Trump to say, get out of the Capitol, everybody except one. And that one person was the person who let the violence go on, who continued to pursue this election decertification effort in the moments while the police officers are being injured, while the building is being destroyed, while the crowd is 40 feet away from Vice President Pence, all these times, in exactly those moments, while he's fully informed, watching everything that's going on like everyone else, he is doing things that aid that strategy. And I think it just blinks reality to think that that's some sort of a coincidence. It's not a coincidence.
Well, let me read this now infamous tweet that was tweeted out by the president, by former President Trump on 2/24 afternoon of January 6th. He says, Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a corrected set of facts, not the fraudulent or inaccurate ones which they were asked to previously certify. USA demands truth. And Carol, at this point, the vice president's life is in serious jeopardy. We've got people roaming the Capitol looking for him. I mentioned the fact that there was a gallows outside on the steps of the or near the steps of the Capitol. And this tweet has gotten a lot of attention, and I think for significant reasons. How do you read it?
Well, the timing is just devastating. Keep in mind at this point, a lot of horrific things have happened, and I've listened to the tape recordings, and some of them have been shared in the hearing last night, but not all of them. You can hear at about 52, Capitol Police Chief Sund saying he needs to declare a riot at the Capitol. You have his actually really despondent voice at about 2:10 declaring that the Capitol has been breached, that people have, with glass breaking, using riot shields, that the rioters, in fact, members of the extremist group, the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, have now gotten inside the Capitol. Chief Sund is saying, breach of Capitol, around 2:10. By 2:19, Vice President Pence's security detail leader, Tim Goebbels, has finally, after three tries, convinced Pence they have to leave. Yeah. They have to leave this hideaway right now, or they may not be able to get out of the building, and takes him to a subterranean parking lot where he hopes they will be secure. It is after all of that that Donald Trump attacks his vice president once again, putting a target once again on his back, saying he didn't have the guts. This tweet is read aloud on the Capitol steps by a man with a bullhorn. I don't know how much more fire the president could have poured on this situation for his own vice president, a loyal soldier for months and months and years, than in sending that tweet at that moment when it is high dudgeon outside. There's a hangman's noose. There are rioters circling to the degree that Secret Service agents believe their own lives are in danger and they may not be able to save the vice president. So for all of that to happen at that moment is sort of not just playing with fire. It is using a gas hose.
Well, we have to take a short break, and just picking up on that, we won't be able to play this clip, but former Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Matthews said that was really adding fuel to the fire, Carol, just to underscore what you were saying there. We are going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation, talking about last night's hearing, what we learned, especially the 187 minutes between former President Trump's Stop the Steal speech and the video he released on the afternoon of January 6th, talking with Carol Lenig, national investigative reporter for The Washington Post, Craig Green, professor of law at Temple University. I do want to read some comments from our listeners, and we'll play some more clips as well. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with our guests Carol Lenig and Craig Green about last night's January 6th hearing. It will take a couple of weeks off and promise that they would be back with some more hearings, some more information come September. Let me read a couple of comments from our listeners, and then I do want to play another clip from last night. Joan says, I want to know why people with guns marching on the mall and in the trees weren't arrested. Since when is it okay for guns to be trotted around D.C.? I'll just let that hang out there. A comment from John, I think one of the reasons Trump didn't tell rioters to go home was that then he would be taking responsibility for them and admitting that they were there because of him. Also an email from Rich. He says, preposterous to even discuss that Trump was deluded or misled or mistaken. This was a coup attempt, pure and simple, and the GOP have been apologists for it ever since. Let me just let those comments hang out there and play another clip. This is committee member Representative Adam Kinzinger asking former White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Matthews about the effort to get Trump to release a statement forcefully condemning the riot. And again, just about a minute.
After the tweet about the vice president, I found Kaylee and told her that I thought the president needed to immediately send out a tweet that condemned the violence that we were seeing and that there needed to be a call to action to tell these people to leave the Capitol. And she agreed and walked over to the Oval dining room to find the president.
We interviewed Ms. McEnany and others who were in the dining room with the president, urging him to put out a statement. Ms. Matthews, Ms. McEnany told us she came right back to the press office after meeting with the president about this particular tweet. What did she tell you about what happened in that dining room?
When she got back, she told me that a tweet had been sent out, and I told her that I thought the tweet did not go far enough, that I thought there needed to be a call to action and he needed to condemn the violence. And we were in a room full of people, but people weren't paying attention. And so she looked directly at me and in a hushed tone shared with me that the president did not want to include any sort of mention of peace in that tweet, and that it took some convincing on their part, those who were in the room. And she said that there was a back and forth going over different phrases to find something that he was comfortable with. And it wasn't until Ivanka Trump suggested the phrase "stay peaceful" that he finally agreed to include it.
I mean, Craig, words do matter. I actually Googled the word sedition. The description I saw: conduct or speech inciting people to rebel against authority of the state. Are we talking about sedition here?
I think that's a possibility. It may depend, sort of like Representative Dean was talking about. It may depend on whether you think of it as in the court of criminal law or in the court of constitutional principle. You know, the president has an obligation to faithfully execute the laws. That's in the Constitution. Certainly what Trump did and aimed to do was to interfere with government and ultimately to overturn an election. And if that were done by a private citizen, of course, sedition in the criminal court, sedition is not frequently charged. But of course, there were 2,000 people who stormed the Capitol. 900 people have been charged with something. A third of them have pled guilty, and several of them have been convicted of seditious conspiracy. But I think that for realistic logistics that we could talk about, I think the criminal aspect, the idea of Trump actually being charged by the Department of Justice, I think in some ways is not the most important thing that should come out of this hearing. And I think there's part of it that's memory and recollection. This is the most dramatic attack on American government, at least since the Civil War. And I think coming to grips with that and thinking what it says about American politics and what it says about constitutional expectations for our public officials, I think that's probably going to end up being much more important than whatever does or doesn't get charged against the former president.
Let me quote something that the Attorney General Merrick Garland said on Wednesday. He said, "No person is above the law. This is the most wide-ranging investigation and the most important investigation the Justice Department has ever entered into," and goes on from there. Carol, how do you see the role of the Justice Department in this whole saga, sad saga?
So I think that there's been a lot of concern among people who see that Donald Trump has behaved in multiple ways without any consequences, without any legal consequences. In the Mueller investigation, you know, he if he were a normal person, he would have been indicted because of 3 to 4 instances in which the Department of Justice had overwhelming evidence that he obstructed a criminal probe. Nothing happened to him as a result. And now the Justice Department is in the situation of looking at a president who's no longer a sitting president. That was the reason that Mueller said he wasn't going to claim that the man engaged in a crime or seek to prosecute him. He was a sitting president. Now he's not. And there are a lot of people asking, if a president can get away with trying to light the match for a coup and engage in what is, in a Justice Department parlance, you know, a conspiracy all day long to defraud and interfere in the government, if the president can get away with that, that's really disturbing to so many. And they don't see the evidence that the Justice Department is really moving aggressively on this front. Mm. However, here's one thing we know. They are investigating. They have taken their time. They haven't done it in a way that goes sort of at the head of the conspiracy that we all saw unfold. And my understanding from sources is that the Justice Department is viewing the January 6th committee's work as extremely illuminating. There were a number of things that they learned, for example, from Cassidy Hutchinson, former White House aide, former Mark Meadows aide, from her testimony that stunned them and does go to the issue of intent or at least state of mind. You know, Craig mentioned earlier the thing that I found the most stunning about Cassidy's testimony, and that was that she recounted how she overheard, personally overheard, the president say he wasn't upset that his supporters were armed, a felony, to carry a weapon on federal property. He wasn't worried about them, and he wanted them to be allowed in with their weapons to his rally, from which he was going to lead them to a Capitol. Armed mob, he was totally comfortable with it. Now, what would have happened if that had all come to pass? Back to the Justice Department, though, and your question. They're on tenterhooks watching this, and the committee both provides some important information to them, some leads, and also puts pressure on the Department of Justice, because now the public is starting to see how easily, let's be fair, how easily the committee has put together this body of evidence. I'm not saying it wasn't hard. They interviewed hundreds of witnesses, but long before the Justice Department has really gotten a grand jury box full of witnesses, the January 6th committee has revealed a lot of new things. And I studied this intensively, and I learned from this group.
Oh, that's fascinating. I mean, Craig, obviously, and I do want to play this clip and move on to a couple of other issues, including the Secret Service, which I will talk to Carol about. But obviously, with the Justice Department, it's a criminal investigation, so it's a whole different set of legal criteria.
And there's a real practical element. So in the end, not just a grand jury, but a jury of 12 folks would have to vote to convict beyond reasonable doubt. And the thing that we're not talking about just yet is there's a huge swath of the American public who believes all the things that no one else believes, and believes what's called the big lie, believes the election was stolen, believes almost anything Donald Trump says. Now, if you're a prosecutor, and I'm not saying these have to be dominant considerations, if you're a prosecutor thinking you're going to get 12 people and not have one of them on it, you might be naive. And then you start thinking about the possibility, well, what if he's indicted, and what if he's tried, and what if it's a hung jury, which he'll claim is an acquittal? And I think that there are real questions on the bottom side of all of that, the same kind of questions, just to be candid, and you know, Carol raised them very well, that face the impeachment proceedings. You can have all the law you want, but law doesn't function independent of the people who are implementing it. And if you think about assembling a jury, or you think of obviously bringing an impeachment to Congress, there is this real dark shadow hanging over everything, which is that the actual result in the end may be nothing like what you might think or think was reasonable or think was even possible.
Let me make a weird segue. This is a clip about Democratic Representative Elaine Loria of Virginia. She showed a photo of Senator Hawley raising his fist in support of protesters. I think we all saw that. Then showed a video of him running through the hall of the Capitol. Let's just give this a quick listen.
Senator Josh Hawley also had to flee. Earlier that afternoon, before the joint session started, he walked across the east front of the Capitol. He raised his fist in solidarity with the protesters already amassing at the security gates. We spoke with a Capitol police officer who was out there at the time. She told us that Senator Hawley's gesture riled up the crowd, and it bothered her greatly because he was doing it in a safe space, protected by the officers and the barriers. Later that day, Senator Hawley fled after those protesters he helped to rile up stormed the Capitol.
Carol, why do you think they singled out Senator Hawley?
You know, a colleague of mine, Philip Bump, said today that the focus on Hawley's fist bump and then his fleeing the same group of people he had helped rile up outside was a shiv from the committee. That was the word he used. And I can't disagree. This was an effort to point out the hypocrisy of individual lawmakers who stoked the fire, who in their desire to be with Trump and claim his enormous base, kept putting themselves, but really more importantly, democracy in danger, their colleagues and democracy in danger, and law enforcement officers. Remember, law enforcement officers were getting the S beat out of them to the point that some had heart attacks, preparing to die and begging to be left alone and not shot with their own gun so that they could still see their children. So the hypocrisy of that. If you say you're a Republican and what you care about is law and order and what you care about is criminal justice, then why rile up this mob and put your law enforcement officers in basically a firing range? So I think that the committee, but particularly motivated by Liz Cheney, has tried to point out Republican peers that she feels let democracy down. Mm. You know, I and Phil Rucker wrote in our book, I Alone Can Fix It, about this final unbelievable catastrophic year, that about a scene in the Capitol as rioters stormed. Liz Cheney was trying to hide, along with a lot of other lawmakers, behind benches as the first folks came into the ceremonial hall after breaking in through the glass. And Jim Jordan, a colleague of hers in the Freedom Caucus, who had championed this rally, if not the attack, reached over and was whispering, calling out to other female lawmakers and Liz Cheney herself, saying, you know, we need to get the women inside the aisles and away from the aisles so that, you know, they're more safe. And she smacked his hand and she said,
"You
get away
that.
From me. You effing did this."
Yeah.
I it still chills me to think about how much she knew at that point about her Republican colleagues' role in the attack that she and they were all experiencing. And Josh Hawley is just, you know, one of the poster children for that now.
Let me play a quick clip. And this is Liz Cheney. She's obviously vice chair of the committee. And this is her final statement, saying that former President Trump took advantage of the patriotism of the January 6th insurrectionists. And Craig, I'll give you a quick response. And then I want to hear very quickly from you, Carol, about the Secret Service. But let's listen and then we'll hear from you, Craig.
Donald Trump knows that millions of Americans who supported him would stand up and defend our nation were it threatened. They would put their lives and their freedom at stake to protect her. And he is preying on their patriotism. He is preying on their sense of justice. And on January 6th, Donald Trump turned their love of country into a weapon against our Capitol and our Constitution.
Craig, what did you make of that?
Yeah, I think that this speaks to the political challenge that's out there for America. So, I watched every minute of all the hearings yesterday in preparation, and nobody in your listening audience will do that. They may not even watch the whole thing from last night, but if they Googled January 6th violence video, I think they'd get a reintroduction, a push away from the numbness that I think people can experience with this. I think this was a huge threat to American democracy, and it does have potential even going forward. And I think that that's the thing to really focus on in a way is, you know, these are facts and these are events that happen in history and people are still denying them. And that's a huge pathology for American politics when things that are true can be called false and the opposite. And I think that this Representative Cheney and I think the committee's hard work I think really cues up for the rest of us political and moral responsibility, a constitutional responsibility as citizens to really think about the things that have happened and how to keep them from happening in the future.
And Carol, this is there's no time to answer this, but I know that you are looking into these Secret Service texts that have disappeared. I'm assuming this is an ongoing investigation.
Yes, stay tuned, and thanks for mentioning it.
Yes.
It's evidence in one of the most important moments in our history, so let's see if we can get it.
And obviously, these are texts on January 5th and 6th, right? Just such a curious omission there.
Well, to be fair, a lot of the texts from all of January have been wiped, and not just those mm-hmm. dates. Those were ones sought, but a lot of them have been deleted.
Well, stay tuned, and we should have you back once we get some more information on that. Carol Lenig, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National investigative reporter for The Washington Post, co-author of a book that came out last year, I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year, 2021. Also did write a book about the Secret Service called Zero Fail. Craig Green, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Professor of Law at Temple University. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.